Welcome to the GCN Show from the Cabot Trail, Nova Scotia, Canada.
Welcome to the GCN Show.
Coming up this week, the fourth dimension of cycling performance and possibly the most important. What is it? And can we all train it?
Plus, two new round-the-world record attempts, why US teenagers are choosing not to drive, and a look at the world's most expensive bras. This week in the world of cycling, we learned that Visma's woes continued last week with one of the nastiest crashes we've seen since... probably since that Tour of the Basque Country one back in April.
Yeah, amongst the many riders who hit the deck on a road that bore more of a resemblance to an ice rink at the Critérium du Dauphiné were Dylan van Baarle and Steven Kruijswijk.
And they were both forced to abandon the race with fractured bones. We also learned that the true spirit of gravel is indeed still alive.
Woohoo!
This is Steve, David and Nick, who competed in a 200-mile unbound race on beach cruisers.
Wow. And apparently, they actually went quicker than Connor did the year before and didn't have to walk either. We also have fair play to them. Actually, you've got to say fair play, guys. That's commitment. Now, we also learned that despite thinking that us cyclists can be pedantic and slightly moany, we have nothing on the fitness community. The comments underneath Saturday's video were hilarious, telling one of the world's top CrossFit athletes that he can't do pull-ups, push-ups, or even squats.
I also enjoyed the fact that you were so bad at it, so bad, in fact, that Kimberly Delgado commented that if Si didn't even try... what's the point in even watching the whole video? Very good
that
point.
That is harsh, that. Really harsh.
But then according to SF, watching you without a top on reminded them to get the chicken out of the freezer.
I can't imagine why. Now, a few other people have pointed out that we should have got Zach, Britain's fittest man, 2019, out on the road on a bike. And yeah, 100%. I think even I would actually be able to beat him outside on a road. But honestly... honestly, I didn't even think I would need to. I thought I'd have him on the ramp test.
I did as well.
I really did. I can do a decent ramp test, even now, but I wasn't expecting him to be able to take it up to 500 watts.
No.
Animal.
He does weigh a bit more than you, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Well, I suppose, as a few of the comments has pointed out, you needed to go longer, really, didn't you?
That's right.
To really show the differing types of fatigue resistance. He wouldn't beat you, I don't think, in a World Gravel Series race.
Hell no. I mean, I hope not, anyway. But yeah, it's a really interesting point, this, looking at fatigue resistance, isn't it? Because like you say, there are different types. Because whilst I was struggling to do any press-ups or pull-ups towards the end of that test, he was fine, still absolutely cranking them out, wasn't he? And fatigue resistance is something that has hit the headlines again recently. So our coffee machine chat this morning was centred around this very fact, around an article, in fact, that we'd seen on Outside by the ever-brilliant Alex Hutchinson.
It was published about a month ago, so we're a bit late to the party, aren't we? But it talked about fatigue resistance being the key to elite performance and the inadequacies of laboratory testing in searching out the next best endurance athletes.
Yeah, so apparently in running circles, the three key measurements are VO2 max, that's your favourite as well, isn't it? Lactate threshold and running economy, which Alex explains that you can then plug into an algorithm that will spit you out your expected marathon time, except that recent research has suggested that it's not quite that simple.
So, the key ingredient missing, apparently, what they're calling the fourth dimension...
it's a good name.
It is a good name.
It's a very cool name, yeah.
Anyway, it's fatigue resistance, in effect. In essence, those with better fatigue resistance don't see their physiological parameters change as much over the course of a race or a training session as those that aren't as gifted in that department.
No, so the article points to a study conducted by runner Jakobsen Unhem. Do you think that's how you pronounce it?
I doubt it, but we'll run with that.
Runner Jakobsen, I got right. Anyway, published in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Sports.
One of your favourites, presumably?
Oh, it's definitely up there. Yeah, definitely up there. In the study, Runner had two groups of participants. One were described as active adults who participated in sport but did no more than 2 days of endurance training per week, whilst the others were trained runners who averaged around 60 kilometres per week.
Quite a bit.
That is a lot, isn't it?
Both groups conducted a VO2 max test before and after a 1 hour steady state run. And whilst there was a decline in VO2 max and running economy in both groups, the rate of decline in the active adults was far greater than the trained runners.
So 5% versus just 1.2% for the running group. Now, what the study didn't show was whether that was a genetic trait, because the runners had far more training under their belts, of course. The second study cited by the article, though, was conducted by James Sprague. I think I used to race against him.
Yeah, I know James.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Now, he's based at the University of Cape Town. It took 14 professional cyclists and got them to burn through 2,000 kilojoules in two different ways.
Yeah. Firstly, through steady-state low-intensity riding, and then secondly, through a series of intervals. Now, the rate of decline was far greater in the interval group, particularly in sprinting ability at the end, suggesting it's the high-end efforts during a race that inhibit the performance that you have at the end of one. There was also a discrepancy among the 14 riders, with some demonstrating far more fatigue than others.
You know, that was a bit that really interested me in that, because you think, like, 14 professional cyclists, they would be
quite
like,
similar.
They would all be amazing at it, but no, some were way better than others. Mats Pedersen, you'd think, would be a great example, wouldn't you, of someone with amazing fatigue resistance, in that his sprint seems to be just as good at the end of a long, hard classic as it would be at the end of a 140-kilometre flat stage of a Grand Tour.
I'd go with that, definitely, yes. He's a prime example, isn't he? But as we mentioned, what we don't know yet is how much this fourth dimension is down to the gift of genetics and how much is trainable or achievable with the correct nutrition.
Yeah, so some studies have shown that higher training volume is associated with greater fatigue resistance. And interestingly, in the Cape Town study, all the riders were fueling with 90 grams of carbs an hour. So the differences weren't down to calorie intake.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, thinking beyond Pedersen, Van der Poel's got to be a great example of a rider with incredible resistance to fatigue, isn't he? So the amount of efforts that he seems to be able to do in a race like the Tour of Flanders, for example, while still having enough left to ride away solo with 40Ks to go or whatever, seems to be what sets him apart.
It does. Or at least it sets him apart when Tadej Pogacar isn't there. Yeah. Another man who appears to have the gift of minimal effects from fatigue.
For the most part, but even Pogacar has suffered the effects of fatigue sort of bestowed upon him by Jonas Vingegaard at the Tour the last 2 years, hasn't
That's
it?
True, yeah.
Surely their absolute power output has to come into this.
How do you mean?
I mean, those riders' critical powers at various durations are much higher than most, even professional. So every time there's an acceleration or an attack within a race, presumably they're riding at a lower percentage of their maximum compared with most others. So they're not going to pay for those efforts as much as other pros.
Yeah, OK, I take your point, actually. I also think, though, that if the top races were half the distance, we would see slightly different results, wouldn't we? So if it's a 50-kilometre stage with a 10K summit finish, for example, I reckon what monsters like Remco Evenepoel or Jay Vine would be far closer to the likes of Pogacar and Vingegaard. It's just that they're not as good deeper into a stage and critically deeper into a stage race as well.
Makes sense, doesn't it? Anyway, let us know your thoughts on this subject. How much do you reckon fatigue resistance is genetic? How much is trained?
I can add my thoughts here.
Go on then.
Well, only just in that one of the things I've noticed is whilst my FTP and all those kind of parameters have decreased over the last, whatever it is, 12 years since I stopped racing full time, like, they've not gone down that much, but yet my performance in like a longer race is rubbish. And it's mainly because, I think, that fatigue resistance. So I keep thinking back to, you know, how hard I raced in the first hour of the Gravel World Series and stuff. And it was hard, but it wasn't that hard. I could definitely have sustained it comfortably, but now...
And you put that down to less time on the bike.
I think
you used to say that age was beneficial to that sort of fatigue resistance. You built up an endurance over time.
Well, I've got good endurance, I think, now at lower intensities. So way better than I had when I was, like, 20. But it's that resistance fatigue at higher intensities that I don't have. And I can't separate it between age or training volume because age is steadily increasing and training volume has been, you know, not very much for the last decade.
Yeah.
But I definitely think I could correct it if I could train properly.
Well, you've got time.
Do you know what we should do? We should maybe ask GCN producers if we could do a science experiment and I could go back to being a full-time cyclist for 4 months.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they'd be down for that.
Yeah, so just like not do any GCN work, just train for 4 months and see whether or not my resistance and fatigue could improve.
I think they'd be quite happy not to see you in the office for a year or so, if I'm perfectly honest. Anyway, Let us know then if you've had your own experience with getting better at dealing with fatigue on bike rides in the comment section just down below.
Yeah, and please don't lobby GCN producers to get rid of me for a year like on leave. I mean, I would like it, but I think I might get quite bored. Right, now moving slightly on, someone who you would think at least has a mind-blowing resistance to fatigue, and they're certainly hoping so anyway, is Lael Wilcox.
Yeah, you might know her from her previous ultra-endurance exploits, including becoming the first American and first woman to win the prestigious Trans Am race, where she averaged 235 miles a day for 18 days, entirely self-supported.
Yeah, she has definitely got fatigue resistance, hasn't she? Anyway, Lael is stepping it up a gear. She is tackling the round-the-world record this time.
Yeah, the target is not Mark Beaumont's 78-day supported one, but rather Jenny Graham's 124-day self-supported one. It's the first time someone has had a meaningful attempt at this for some time. Both records were considered to be very much on the shelf.
Yeah, in part, so we understand from Mark Beaumont, actually, because Russia was considered the key to a fast route, but now was kind of a bit risky, I think. Yeah. And also the Trans-Siberian Highway, apparently, was horrible to cycle on. Who'd have thought it? However, Lael's route is completely different. She's spending more time in southern Europe, something that, so I don't think Beaumont went to southern Europe at all, really. Yeah. Apart from on his way back, he went Portugal, Spain and up to Paris. But then Lael's going through the Balkans before then flying straight to Australia and then New Zealand before then spending longer in North America on her way back to Chicago to finish.
Now, you may wonder how you can ride around the world despite missing Asia, Africa and South America. But the rules require a minimum distance of 18,000 miles, continuous direction of travel and hitting both hemispheres.
That's right. So she kind of ticks the boxes, we think, yeah. Now, we asked Jenny Graham for the insider insight on Lael's route, and she said that she thinks she might have made a really smart choice in terms of safety, border crossings and generally easy countries to travel in. And you've got to say, currently Lael looks like she's doing super well, ahead of her schedule, which requires an average of 163 miles per day. Currently, she's on 170.8 miles a day.
Some in the bank.
Yeah, we've got to say, actually, if you want to keep up to date with Lael's exploits, then there's a podcast, a daily podcast. Yeah,
a daily one, is there?
Yeah, which is super cool. So, do check that one out.
You can dot watch as well, can't you?
And you can dot watch over on the Rafa website,
I think it is.
That'd be good.
Lael, though, might actually have some competition, mightn't she, before she has even completed her trip around the world, though. Vedangi Kulkarni, who's next Indian footballer, is setting out to do exactly the same thing this July.
Yeah, her aim is to cycle 270 to 300 kilometres a day. I realise we've flipped from imperial to metric there.
We have, yeah.
But that's more. Yeah, that's more than Lael's 170. What is it? That's like 180 miles a day if you're doing 300k, I think.
Yeah, I worked out that Lael has averaged 275k's a day, so it could be just a bit above that as she's at the top of end of her aim.
Yeah, anyway, she doesn't have the same degree of success in ultra-endurance racing as Wilcox. However, she did ride across the Himalayas at the age of 17.
Impressive.
It's not bad. And crucially, she's already done one lap of the world. She became the youngest woman to do so at just 20.
Wow. This is going to be interesting, isn't it? It's great to see these records being taken on again.
Absolutely, yeah. Flipping love a bit of dot watching.
And now it's time for cycling shorts.
Cycling shorts now, and we're going to start with news of cycling tops. Although not complete tops, but rather Castelli's new aero bra.
Called the Bolero Short Sleeve. It's a rather skimpy affair.
It is, yeah. It's not really a bra at all, is it? Because there's some crucial bits missing, we should say.
First thought I had was, good that they found a model whose nipples aren't arguing with each other.
They look like normal nipples, don't they? But was that actually your first thought?
No, it wasn't really my first thought. My first thought was, what? You know, that was my first thought. And then my second thought was, how much?
Oh, you fancy one, do you? Well, it's 99 quid. Mm. So that is for a couple of shoulder sleeves joined together by some fabric across your back. It seems a bit steep, doesn't it?
It does. Well, that's cycling for you, as we all know, isn't it? Whilst I was in the office earlier, though, I googled expensive bras and came across an Agent Provocateur Diana Plunge underwide bra. Cost 525 quid.
Whoa.
And that's the sale.
And that doesn't help you go faster either, does it?
No. Does offer support, though, apparently.
Well, yeah, far more so than the Castelli Bolero. Anyway, I guess it just goes to show that it's not just cycling that offers reassuringly expensive products. We should point out that the Aero Bra, or Aero Bolero, is actually not a new concept, is it? Both Alex and Ollie have Aero Boleros in their closet, but from a different brand. Yeah. But this, we understand, is Castelli's first foray into this line of products.
It is. Yeah. Anyway, just before we move on, unfortunately, they are not available in extra small, small or medium.
Ooh.
Although I think I might need an XL now because I've been pumping quite a lot of iron down the gym recently.
You can actually tell as well. I mean, I don't know whether you lot can tell at home, but I can tell sat here.
Side on.
Yeah.
I won't do that. I mean, I've still got 4 months to go in my journey. Well, I've got hopefully many years to go in my journey.
Good, yeah.
Until the end of the journey on the GCN series.
This is going to be amazing. I can't wait for that thumbnail.
The trouble is, if I put weight on with muscle, it's at the behest of VO2 max, isn't it?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Partly weight.
Well, the other issue as well is if your pecs get bigger, that's going to move your nipples even further apart. That's a dilemma, isn't it?
I need to work on my back. I don't know what I need to do. Anyway.
Corrective surgery, perhaps? I don't know. Right, sticking with kit. The latest fashion brand to try their hand at cycling clothing is H&M. Now, you might remember we talked about Zara's new cycling kit a year or so ago, probably even more than that, actually. But it's great to see another mainstream brand dip into the cycling market.
It's part of their active wear range aimed at making cycling kit more affordable to more people. So the jersey retails for £45 and the bib shorts for £75, with a range of colour choices in both.
That does not seem that affordable to me. I mean, it's reasonable,
yeah,
but it's not cheap, is it?
I guess not, no. Although it looks good, doesn't it, in comparison to Law's new $1,800 cycling shoes, which are 3D printed to your exact requirements based on a scan of your feet.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that. Like, honestly, all I'm really thinking when I look at those shoes is that there'll be a nightmare to clean.
I thought that, yeah.
Like, what with it, you know, if you can't see what we're looking at because you're listening to this, they're like no part of that shoe is like a solid material. It's all like webbed and like a matrix of.
Need a lot of toothbrush action to.
I think you just have to jet wash the stuff out of the middle of that.
I wouldn't want to jet wash $1,800 shoes.
No, but I also wouldn't want to carry around like a load of grit in my $1,800 like holy souls. Anyway, there we go. I don't think I'll ever get to try $1,800 shoes, so I'll never know.
After what we've just said.
No, right. On last week's show, I spent quite a lot of time.
A lot of time.
Yeah, talking about a shared road close to me at my home in Bristol and about a sign offering cyclists the opportunity to get the experience of what an HGV driver, so a truck driver, can see on the road.
It sort of sounds like you're about to bang on about the same subject again.
Because we didn't hear enough about it last week. Well, yes, but only because it provoked a lot of comments. Basically, we said it was a difficult topic, this one, but my issue was that it places the emphasis of safety on the cyclist as opposed to the truck driver, which I feel effectively constitutes victim blaming.
Yeah. Oh, we had an email, didn't we, directly from Karen Donahue, who pointed out that the HGV drivers do indeed spend a day as part of their training on cyclist and pedestrian vulnerability, including taking drivers out on the road.
Yeah, on the road, on bikes, we should say. And that is really good to know. And it would explain why typically HGV drivers are super considerate and conscious on the roads, aren't they? And honestly, I am torn with this because I know how important it is for cyclists to be aware of HGVs turning circles and their blind spots and so forth. But I've got to say, it still doesn't change the fact that victim blaming is incredibly toxic. So in recent years, the tragic spate of cyclist deaths as a result of trucks and HGVs turning left here in the UK, turning right in other countries. And here in the UK, it was mainly in the media attributed to dangerous road layouts, I think, wasn't it? And as a result, I think it's been used to help fuel the campaign for improved cycling infrastructure, which we are beginning to get in the UK. But it could just as easily be hijacked by people saying that actually those deaths were the result of the cyclist and then nothing changes.
Yeah, I do see that. There is a real blind spot about the dangers of motor vehicles full stop. And it would be all too easy for it to be seen as being the cyclist's fault, wouldn't it? When actually, it shouldn't have to be that dangerous. And this comment from Rob C, I thought, was food for thought. The hilarious thing about construction vehicles, though, is that on site, they have to drive at minimal speed, have some sort of hazard warning lights, and with somebody wearing high vis, guiding them to keep other workers safe within the site. Once out of the site, low visibility, poor excuse for bad design, national speed limit, no marshalling, no hazard warning lights. Some really good points.
It's a really good point, isn't it, actually? I mean, yeah, when you're really worried about health and safety, you've got to appreciate that those things are super dangerous, haven't you? And it was also really interesting. In fact, for me, comment of the week last week, it was this one from Roshan Mia. He said, I'm a London bus driver and I can't tell you the number of times a week some colleagues have trouble with cyclists for close calls or misunderstandings. And yet, myself and other regular cycling colleagues will only have similar incidents, perhaps only a few times a year. I'd encourage anything that allows different road users a perspective of each other's headspace.
Mm. Implying, I think, that drivers can do more, but there's a real value in educating cyclists too, because it's only when we can all see the road from other road users' perspective that we can truly get a grip.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like that. I really am intrigued as well to the thought that a cycling bus driver has less issues with cyclists than a non-cycling bus driver.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, Roshan, get in touch again and maybe we'll come and catch your bus. And we're not allowed Transport for London won't let us film on your bus, as you know, but let's have a chat about cycling and buses. Right, moving on, although slightly linked, unfortunately, to the previous topic, a bit of racing news now. And whilst Visma Lisa Bike have been having a lot of bad luck this year, Life Plus Wahoo are giving them a run for their money, aren't they?
Yeah, this is awful, actually. So in the run-up to the Tour of Britain, their rider, Kate Richardson, was hit by a 4x4 in training in what was described as a particularly scary crash. So the driver decided to overtake her on a very narrow road, hit her and threw her from her bike, and then to add insult to literal injury, he then turned around, not to see if she was all right, but to verbally abuse her as she lay on the floor.
What an absolute...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, lunatic for a start. Like, that is utterly crackers, isn't it? You kind of hope that someone like that would end up getting, like, I don't know, in trouble with the law. For grievous bodily harm and all the other bits and bobs.
From everything else you read about people that have been killed through driving, they don't get much behind bars, do they?
No. Anyway, we wish Kate all the best in her recovery and, gutted for her that she'd missed out on the Tour of Britain. But then, at the Tour of Britain itself, the team's woes continued because they had all 14 of their Ribble race bikes and spare bikes stolen from their hotel.
Yeah. We'll finish with a much nicer part of this story, though, in that other teams from the race stepped in to provide the riders there with bikes so that they could continue.
That's it, yeah. You could get an interesting bike review, couldn't you, from the Life Plus Wahoo riders? They could compare their experiences on their new race bikes. Right, some news from the US now, where there is the suggestion that teenagers are delaying getting a driving licence because they're already mobile and independent thanks to the use of e-bikes.
Yeah, so e-bike sales tripled in the US between 2019 and 2023, whilst the number of teens with driver's licences has actually fallen by about 8%, albeit over the past 20 years. That's according to the Federal Highway Administration.
Yeah, if that is the latest trend, then long may it continue. Although it has to be said that e-bikes in America, from my experience of going to California to see Otter a few weeks back, is that they don't require pedalling.
Oh.
Everyone's just cruising. They're basically just motorbikes. Everyone's cruising around in motorbikes. Yeah. Which, to be fair, is better still than driving a car.
Well, you have that in the UK as well, though, don't you? And this is a subject I've talked to you about at the coffee machine.
Yeah, this guy Dan's got a right bee in his bonnet about this.
We'll leave that for another time.
Pesky e-bikes, yeah. We will finish cycling shorts instead with a bit of a teaser, shall we? So you don't have long to wait to find out, but Zwift have got something exciting coming tomorrow. So stay tuned to GCN for that. They're definitely having a go at shaking things up again. So see what you think tomorrow. Let us know.
Hack /bodge of the week now. Don't forget, you can upload your hacks and bodges by going to upload.globalcyclingnetwork.com. Four for you this week, the first of which comes in from Injector GCN. Sorry. Protect your bike frame when fixing a puncture. When fixing a roadside front tyre puncture, you can use your shoes to keep your fork from touching the ground while keeping your bike upright. Use your pedal for additional stability. This beats putting the bike upside down, which can scratch the lever hoods or the saddle. Bonus points, you can relax without shoes while fixing the puncture.
This is something I've never thought about, Dan.
Which part?
The undersize of my fork.
Have you not? I have.
Blades. Really?
Yeah, I mean, if they're carbon, nice matte finish or something, the last thing you want to do is have it on tarmac.
Well, I guess
like,
so.
But I think like that, even unfortunate enough to borrow bikes rather than pay for them.
This is when do you look at the underside of your fork blade?
Well, that's not the point. I just, you know, if it's an expensive bike, I want to keep it immaculate.
So. I'm trying to think what I do. I don't think I ever, like, rest it on its fork blades when I'm
I think I'd always... In the background of that shot, we should say for podcast listeners that the fork blade is inserted in either shoe that's been removed from said feet.
Yes.
In the background there's a fence. You can just sort of rest the edge of the handlebar on the fence, can't you, with a drop
handlebar.
That's
a good shout.
That's what
yeah.
I normally do.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose that's a good idea, but I would never take my shoes off when fixing a puncture.
Only works on dry days. Also, as I think you know, Si, I've got incredibly sensitive soles of my feet.
I did know that, actually.
Have I never told you about the story of me trying to get out of the sea in Nice on holiday back in 2009?
Funny enough, I've never...
I've got a video somewhere. I had to crawl up like a crab because Lorraine found it so funny. She videoed me coming out of the sea. I literally can't walk on stones at all.
Really?
No.
No. There's something I didn't know about Daniel.
Anyway, so it would have to be very
smooth
surface.
So this video exists, does it?
I think it does. I'll have to go back and find it.
I think we're all wanting to see Dan. I love it. It's like your James Bond moment, getting out of the sea, like all buff and cool.
I'm just like a crab.
That's absolutely amazing.
I mean, Nice Beach is particularly stony. But yeah, I have no
aggressive
hope.
Stones.
No hope walking on stones at all.
There we go. All right. Well, yeah, so Dan can't do this, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say bodge. I feel like that's, like, unnecessary.
I'm going to say hack, because I care more for my bikes than Si does.
No, I wouldn't say that. I just, like...
You should use a different technique, do you?
I'd lie it on its side, to be honest with you. I'd rather get a little scratch on my pedal than...
Why get a scratch anywhere?
Well, I mean, if I had to do something with it, I'd just pop it gently on its side.
Hmm. All right, let us know your thoughts on that one then in the comments section down below.
How do you deal with your bike in a puncture stop?
In a puncture situation.
There we go, yeah. Well, that's a video in the making, I feel like, Dan. Right, so I've said bodge, you're saying what?
Hack.
Okay, all right, you're on the fence on this one. Ryan Brink, now this is an interesting one, a modern down tube shifter, Ryan's saying. So a co-worker of mine rides one by cyclocross, but occasionally does gravel races. So this is the intriguing bit. For climbs, Ryan says, he throws on a SRAM Axis rear derailleur, and instead of messing with the shifters, he's used the accessory mounts on his down tube and a rubber strap to mount the SRAM Axis shifter from his mountain bike. He's then got a dedicated wheel with cassette and longer chain to finish up the conversion. So anytime he rides his mountain bike with this SRAM Axis mullet setup, he has to use a down tube shifter.
Mm. I mean, I think there's a reason why down tube shifters are no longer a thing in general. And that's because, especially riding off road, you don't really want to take your hands off the handlebars to shift gears, do you?
To think that this person values wider gear ratios over being able to shift from your handlebars. Like, I mean, you've got to be tackling some serious climbs to need something bigger than a 36 tooth cassette, I think.
Do you think this is Ryan's co-worker, or do you just think he's so embarrassed to admit that this is his own bodge?
Well, I would never admit that, unless it was a case of, like, get out of jail free card, my bike's completely totaled, and I've just had to cannibalise some bits from my mountain bike to go out tomorrow.
Mm.
That's the only possible reason why that is acceptable. Otherwise, that's horrific.
There is the chance I'm just completely misunderstanding what's going on here. I mean,
well, there is that chance.
In rehearsals, I had to ask Si what was going on.
Rehearsals? What are they?
I'm joking. When we had a quick discussion 2 minutes ago, I did have to ask you what on earth was going on.
Yeah, it's not terribly clear, is it? But no, I...
wasn't after your explanation either.
Thanks. But I think it's just terrible. Massive bodge. Worst bodge I've ever seen. Yeah, okay.
We're both going bodge, but if we've got that completely incorrect, let us know. Next one comes from Mark Bebe. 3D printed galleon figure. Wanted something personal on my bike, so made a 3D file of this galleon figure and got this printed in wax, then a lost wax casting so it could be cast in bronze.
Wow! That's unbelievable! I mean, I never thought that bikes needed figureheads, but now I've seen this work of art with, what are they, like falcons maybe? And then that kind of like...
Some sort of bird, yeah.
Flower in the middle. Goodness me.
I mean,
attached to your head unit.
Helps
there.
Your bike stand out from the crowd, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, arguably, it's not the most effective weight addition to a bike. No. But, you know, sometimes you've got to prioritise style over speed, haven't you? When it comes to a figure, what would you have on your figurehead for your bike?
Crikey. I mean, it's not something I've ever thought about, so on the spot, I'm struggling. You?
What came to me then was a Whippet. So as a Whippet owner, feel like that's what I would like to channel. Obviously, their endurance is great.
Let's get two, mate, because I've got a Bedlington Whippet.
Okay, yeah.
Sorted.
Yeah.
Hack or bodge?
Hack. Yeah, I don't know why, but...
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't choose to have one myself. I couldn't actually make one myself. No. That's part of the reason, but I'm still going hack.
Yeah. Poor resistance to fatigue Whippets.
Are they?
Well, I mean, they get pretty tired, don't they, pretty quick?
Yeah.
And then they just, you know... Yeah, then they sort of lounge around like professional athletes.
Pretty bloody fast when they're not fatigued.
Well, that's kind of I see myself in a Whippet, to be quite honest. But anyway, there we go. Thanks for sending that one in. Lastly, we've got JRJ. Junior Jack Nick, something like that. Carbon aero clock. I cracked a 50mm carbon rim in a minor crash and had it replaced. Couldn't face throwing away an almost perfect rim, so made it into a clock. It's got cassette sprockets in the middle and a 3D printed hub, in inverted commas, to lace the spokes to and hold the clock mechanism in place. I tell you what, we've seen a few bike-related clocks over the years, but that one, I think, is pretty cool.
That's the most high-end wheel-made clock that I think we've had sent into the show, isn't it?
That is
like the agent provocateur of wheel clocks, isn't it?
I mean, I didn't look at the bra that you're referring to, but yeah, I mean, that's high-end. Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's wicked, actually. Nice work.
Hack?
It is a hack from me,
Hack from me as well.
Because it's got 3D printed stuff on it.
Yeah.
So absolute
it's
win
It's got
there.
A lot going for it, that clock.
It does, yeah.
I've got a lot of time for that.
Yay, it's really good. Do you think everyone stopped watching?
Not now.
Yeah, okay, your point.
20 minutes ago.
All right, okay. Well, anyway, as we said a moment ago, do keep your hacks and bodges coming in. As you can see, we still take great delight in looking at your hacks and bodges. It's time now for caption competition, that part of the show where you get a chance to get your hands on a coveted GCN Camelback water bottle. All you got to do is put a witty caption in the comments section down below. We'll pick a winner next week. And we'll give you the results from last week, first of all.
This was last week's photo. Jonas Abrahamsson on the podium. The Brussels Cycling Classic after his first ever pro win. Swigging on a large bottle of Lidl Prosecco or champagne with a GoPro on top.
Could be Carver.
Could be Carver, yep. Could be orange juice.
Could be sparkling wine, actually.
This week, with a cracking, very humorous caption, is Brian G. Link 182. But if this is a Lidl bottle, I'd hate to see the Jumbo one.
Hey!
Maybe I should have said Jumbo.
That's very good. I like that. Top notch, Brian. Well done. Get in touch, and we will get your GCN Camelback water bottle out to you.
This week's photo comes from the Critérium du Dauphiné. It's a picture at the start line of Primoz Roglic in the yellow jersey. To his right is Giulio Ciccone of Lidl Trek, who I think is just trying to hear what Primoz Roglic is saying. He's got his head sort of bowed with his ear pointed towards Primoz Roglic's mouth.
But his face is looking towards Primoz Roglic's what, shoe? Knee?
Shoe, I would say, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I will get you started. Hey, Giulio, I'm sitting on my bike with one cheek only.
One cheek only?
Yeah.
Oh, my word. I mean, I don't know whether you heard. It got an actual real-life chuckle from Isaac behind the camera, which I thought was like...
It wasn't a chuckle, it was a snigger.
As in like a, oh, God. Just like a, oh, an eye roll. I didn't think that was your best effort, mate, but
no,
still.
Probably not, no. Not my best work.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I guess it's a real dad joke, isn't it? I'm probably not too far off of granddad jokes. My oldest son's 21 at this point. Another 10 years.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Are the granddad jokes worse or better than dad jokes?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I really don't know. I was hearing about a guy that was a granddad at the age of 28.
No.
Yep.
Fair play.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but anyway, there we go. Good for childcare duties, I guess.
I mean, if we didn't have many people watching by the end of Hack and Bodge,
we've lost
audience
them all
retention
now.
This week is going to be horrific.
Oh dear God, I'm so sorry, everyone. Get your witty captions down in the comment section down below, and we'll pick a winner next week.
We've got a lot of cracking comments to get through before we let you know what's coming up on GCN this week. Yeah. I had a few from last week's show already, haven't we? But we picked out these as well. First up from Matt Southerden. Euros ruined gravel. Seems fair. An American ruined the tour.
Yay! Ba-boom. I like that. Well done, Matt. Dave Howes said, bicycle racing / fast group riding attracts obsessive people. It's only a matter of time before the casual becomes hyper-competitive. This is also in relation to gravel racing. Mm. And, yes, the so-called spirit of gravel. I mean, I think everyone's now kind of, like, actually not thinking that there is a spirit of gravel. We're just joking about it, aren't we? Because it was quite funny in the first place. I don't think anyone genuinely thinks but that there is a spirit of gravel.
We should probably knock it on the head. I think people are getting sick of us talking about the spirit of gravel
probably,
at this point. But wait a year, we'll be back there again.
Yeah.
This came in from Michael Newman 4302. I wasn't watching Unbound, I was riding it. Thank you for selecting my Welcome to the GCN Show intro. My shameless ploy worked. And thank you, Michael, for sending it in.
Absolutely,
Upload.globalcyclingnetwork.com if you'd like to do your own intros. Whilst Dennis Mung puts, sigh, stop leaning forward. You're changing the focal plane. Therefore, only one of you can be in focus at the same time. You're essentially half-wheeling your co-host on air. Lol.
Yeah, so I didn't realise this, Dennis. I have been trying to get ahead of Dan for some time now, but I'll stop, basically. I'm sorry about that. I have no idea.
So I wouldn't half-wheel me, just drop me, wouldn't you?
That's funny, that, mate. Right, underneath the Zone 2 training tips video, so this was things Manon learnt, effectively, from her month of doing Zone 2. Chisco Chang said, I love my Zone 2 rides. They're 1.5 hours long, and I make a point of leaving my phone tucked away just for an emergency, but just me, nature, and my thoughts. Not a single worry on my mind. Therapeutic. So I almost think that's not a Zone 2 ride. That's just a ride, isn't it? Just like, you know... I mean, it's cool to have a goal in mind at the same time, but actually just getting out there and just enjoying.
No, that is a big part of exercise out and about, isn't it? Is that you do just normally have your phone tucked in your back pocket. You don't look at it for an hour and a half to 3 hours, whatever the ride length might be.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. You don't get that, even in a gym, which I have been enjoying doing, because you need to rest between sets, the automatic impulse is to just reach into your pocket and grab your phone and look at it between sets.
But you know one thing I've noticed, right? So, because I've been doing, like, trying to do one run a week still, I've been noticing other runners out and about now, and I see a lot of people running wearing rucksacks, like carrying bags when they're going out for a jog. Anyway, so I was chatting to a friend of mine who is a runner, and he was saying that a lot of people just is to put their phones in because they cannot be without their phone, even for like a 30-minute run.
Do you go out without your phone?
I do, yeah. I just go out with my Wahoo watch on to record it.
I go out with my phone, but I've got sort of very long North Face shorts. I'm not sure if they're running shorts, but they've got deep pockets and they're sort of quite tight, so the phone doesn't bounce about all over the place.
Well, that's just as well.
Yeah, well, it can be quite painful.
Yeah, good. No, but I just... the thought of... But this mate was saying that people who go to running races with a phone because they can't be without their phone for that. Mm. I couldn't believe it, really.
No.
There we go. Anyway.
How to remove a rear wheel on a road bike in 2024. E-Butoy. But really good advice. Not sorry for posting this comment, but it should be. That was a joke that Si pulled out earlier in Hack or Bodge.
It was terrible. And then under Connor's awesome video where he took part in the Tuscany Trail, which I think if you watch that video, I challenge you not to add it to your bucket list. Bigotry said, slow-paced, non-competitive content is great for Connor. His joy is infectious. And actually, he finished it quite quickly when he didn't have to race it. Mm. So, well done, Connor. And then Jürgen Egbal said, thank you for bringing back the spirit of GCN Plus to Connor and the team. This had all the elements that made GCN Plus film so epic and motivating, with a beautiful and challenging route, great B-roll, drone shots, music, and lovely editing. Mm. So, it was a cracking watch that. If you've not seen it yet, then put 40 minutes aside and go and check it out.
We do have some great editors, don't we?
We do, yeah.
Otherwise, we'd look even worse than we do.
Well, yeah.
On the screen.
The amount that gets cut out of this show each and every week.
Oh, they're gold on the cutting room floor over the last 11 years.
Oh,
crazy.
To think about the wastage.
They should scoop all that up and we wouldn't have to work for another couple of years, would we? Right, coming up on this channel this week, Wednesday's TBC, so you're going to be surprised with that one. But on Thursday, how to choose the best bike for your commute.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I enjoyed making that one, actually. And then on Friday, sorry, I say Thursday again. Does crank length matter? How short should you go? And this is with Connor, who, obviously, given his additional height, has long been an advocate of very long cranks. But yeah, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what Connor's found out about cranks. And then on Saturday, this is a really cool one you were involved in the other week, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Last Tuesday evening, I travelled up to High Wycombe, there at Prince's Ridgeborough, actually, to the High Wycombe CC Evening 10, a club that's celebrating its 100th anniversary.
Our global audience are there going, oh, yeah, High Wycombe. Yeah, yeah, just outside just, Prince's Ridgeborough.
Prince's Ridgeborough, yeah. Anyway, David Miller basically started out his competitive life there as a 14-year-old. His mum took him along to an Evening 10. He did a 10-mile time trial in 25 minutes or so. He also went back in 2006 whilst a fully-fledged pro and set the unofficial course record, because it wasn't an open time trial, of 19 minutes and 7 seconds. Anyway, he's getting fit again. Nowhere near as fit as he was as a pro, of course. But he's got all the up-to-date aero equipment, skin suit and everything else. And so he thought he'd see how close he could get to his old record.
Nice!
Surprise ending to that one, not just for viewers, but for David himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Oh, intriguing. Definitely going to be checking that one out. And then on Sunday, Hank has been at it again. So Hank decided to try and copy Wout Van Aert's training for a week. And I love the way that Hank does these, because he didn't really look at the context. So he was like, oh, it's wicked, because he's had a few easy days, so he's obviously taking it steady. And it was like, Hank, he's just recovered from the Tour of Norway, and so now he's going to start training again. So anyway, Hank has had a tough week. So yeah, make sure you check that one out.
If I was going to do that, I would have done it the week after his crash at Dwars Door Vlaanderen. I think about a week later, he did a 2K walk, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
I could have mustered up that.
Yeah, there you go. No, but that should be super cool to watch anyway. So yeah, check it out.
Fantastic. Well, thanks to both of you for sticking here to the end of the GCN show this week. We'll be back same time next week.
Even the person behind the camera has gone, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.